Good morning, everybody. It's great to be with you. I've been looking forward to coming and sharing with you all. And as Carol said, I'm going to be looking at the beginning of the story of the life of Gideon. If we can get the slides up, Craig, and then I'll see if I can get the clicker to work. We're looking at the beginning part of the story of Gideon. The reason we're doing this, to be quite blunt, is that at church we're planning an autumn series, and we've decided that we're going to do a series based on almost what I'd call second division or championship Old Testament characters. In other words, not the Premier League players of Abraham and Moses and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and all of that. We're going to be looking at people that are well known, but perhaps weren't quite the main players that those characters I've just mentioned are. So we're going to be looking at people like Samson and Jonah and Deborah and Rahab. And I'm starting off with Gideon. So this is a bit of a dry run. I hope you don't mind being guinea pigs. So this is something that I may be delivering with a few tweaks in a couple of 3 weeks' time. I was just chatting to Craig yesterday about this series, and I said, well, you know, all of these people that we're talking about either had flaws in their character or flaws in their circumstances and situations. And Craig said, and I think it was really true, he said, well, when you look in the Bible, that's pretty much everybody. And I thought, that's really right. Actually, although that we've looked at these people and looked particularly at their character flaws and the problems that they had in their circumstances, it seems very rare that the people that God uses don't have flaws and issues and problems. In fact, I've really been struggling to think of anybody that was kind of perfect other than obviously Jesus. You know, you look at people that were strong in their own strength, and they had massive flaws in their circumstances. John the Baptist, you know, had horrific problems and ended up being beheaded. Daniel was a really, really strong, educated guy, but he was in captivity. And I've really struggled just over the last 24 hours to think of somebody. Perhaps afterwards you can come up and think of a person, either in the Old or the New Testament, that's not Jesus, who really seemed to have his whole act together. You know, he was a rounded character without any apparent flaws and actually placed in a really good, healthy situation. I can't think of anybody that fits into that. As I say, with Gideon, you probably know quite a bit about Gideon, and I don't want to concentrate on his achievements and the battles that he was involved in. I want to talk about his character and his calling, and we're going to be looking at Judges chapter 6. The whole verses will be coming on the screen behind me, and that's where we're going to be digging into it. Now, this period, if I can just set the scene for you, this is the period in the story of the people of Israel. After they'd occupied the promised land, so they'd entered the promised land, but before they had kings to rule over them. It was a period of the time of the judges, as they were called. And these were the leaders that weren't royalty, but these were the people who judged and who led the people of Israel. And when you read this part of Scripture, you'll very much see that the people of Israel went through cycles. And these cycles tended to go like this. They'd have a period of time where they were really focused on God and God's law, on obeying him, that the law of God was kind of central to their lives, the worship of God was central to the way that they lived their lives, and God blessed them. And then they would fall into seasons of disobedience, of forgetting about God, ignoring him, worship of God wasn't central. They very often brought idols and other gods into the land. So God turned his back on them. And then they would be attacked by outsiders because they disobeyed God. God allowed outside armies to come and attack them. And then when things got really bad, they felt it was time to turn back to God. They would repent. And time again, the Lord saved them. And it just seemed to be this cycle that they went through. And although it's easy for us to perhaps rather cynically look at them and say, well, how foolish, we can really be like that, can't we? Just perhaps not as the extremes that they suffered. But aren't there times in our life where God seems so central to us, so important, our all in all? You know, we can't wait to open our Bibles and to pray and to spend time with him and to serve him. And then life somehow gets in the way, and before we know it, we've just kind of lived our own life and drifted away from God. I'm sure I'm not unique in that being my experience. I'm sure that we all go through that. But at the end of Judges chapter 5, we're told that the people of Israel had actually gone through a really good period. It says that the land had rest for 40 years. So they'd gone through a period of peace and prosperity. But that season was just about to come to the end. Now, I'm going to press this the right way, hopefully. Let's see if this works. Wow, we have the technology. So this is Judges chapter 6, and it says, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years, that's 7 years after the 40 years we've just been talking about, he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Now, note here, God himself brought the people of Israel into bondage. He allowed this to happen, and he did it because he wanted them to turn back. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep, nor cattle, nor donkeys. They came up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count them or their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. So this is a pretty desperate picture. The Israelites had 40 years of peace and prosperity, and they've now had 7 years of being totally oppressed by this group of people called the Midianites. They weren't actually a nation. They were kind of like vagabonds, rough people that were really oppressing them. It had got that bad that they'd left their homes. They were living in holes in the ground and caves and in the mountains, so they'd all had to leave their homes. The whole nation was scared. They were humiliated. And God had to allow them to get to this point of being completely humbled, because it wasn't for 7 years until they decided that they would cry out to God for help. Again, just the question, how long are we prepared to suffer before we cry out to God? How long do we try and fix things ourselves? How often do we do things in our own strength rather than going back to God? And God often is waiting for us to return to him. Verse 3 that we just read is really important, because it says this, that whenever they'd sown anything, the Midianites kind of waited to attack. They waited for the harvest before they attacked them. It must have been so disheartening. You know, they'd be doing the plowing, the sowing, the harvesting, the threshing, and then they were robbed right at the end of that process. I genuinely think that unrewarded labor is one of life's toughest challenges. It's really heartbreaking to put your heart and your life into something for it to be kind of snatched away just before the culmination of it. This is what they were experiencing. They were working for nothing. Israel's sin was causing them to be robbed of absolutely everything. And that's what sin does in our lives. It can rob us of absolutely everything, the fruits of our hard labor. There are some men and some women who have lost everything because of sin in their lives, because they haven't dealt with it. They've not been at a point where they've come back to God, and sin robs and robs and robs completely and totally if we allow it to. So they'd been oppressed, they'd been humiliated. Everything they'd got had been taken away from them, and they then, after 7 years, turned back to God. How often is prayer our last resort rather than our first resource? How often is prayer our last resort rather than our first resource? We take our time so often to come to God. Verse 7 carries on. When the Israelites cried out to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet who said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I rescued you from the hands of the Egyptians, and I delivered you from the hand of all of your oppressors. I drove them out before you, and I gave you their land. I said to you, 'I'm the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live.' But you've not listened to me." Do you see what God does first? They get to the point where they're totally humbled and humiliated and devastated. They cry out to God, and God, it doesn't say, "And then God sent Gideon." It says God sent a prophet. That was God's way of dealing with things. He sent a prophet to start with, not a deliverer. The reason for that is this. Before the battle could be fought in the natural world, there was a spiritual battle which had to be fought first. And again, folks, I believe that's often the way in our lives. That we may have issues that have to be dealt with. We may have problems in our lives. We may cry out to God for deliverance from a situation. And God may actually want to send us a prophet to speak into our lives. He may want to say, "You need to put the spiritual side of things right before I can deal with the natural things." God, through his prophet, reminded them of everything he'd done in the past. "I brought you out of Egypt. I've dealt with your oppressors. I've given you the land." He had to keep reminding them to give them the confidence that he'd saved them once and he could save them again. Don't we, so often when we're facing problems, need to look back to the cross of Jesus, to realize what he did for us, to remind ourselves of his death and his sacrifice and his resurrection and his salvation and his redemption? That's what Jesus did for us on the cross, and we need to constantly, in our mind's eye, be looking back to that, reminding ourselves of what God's done, reminding ourselves of his power and his love, winning the spiritual battles in the here and now based on our confidence that God gave us in the past and believing that he will deliver us in the future. The problem was they'd stopped obeying God. So often we want to blame other people for our problems when we ourselves are often, not always, but often the cause of our own problems. So the story goes on. The angel of the Lord came, sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a winepress to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Gideon replied, "If the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us to the hand of Midian." Judges 6 doesn't actually tell us that the Israelites must have responded to the prophet, but I believe they must have responded to the prophet because the Lord then decided that he was going to deliver them using Gideon. So I'm sure that they'd obeyed God, they'd heard the prophet, they'd acted on it, and then Gideon is visited. Most people believe he was actually, it says the angel of the Lord, but when we read some of the verses, it seems that it was the Lord himself, or even Jesus himself, visiting Gideon at this time. But firstly, note what Gideon was doing. It says here, Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press. Now let me tell you, that's not normal behavior. Wine presses were normally kind of underground. You know, they'd put the grapes into the vats down in the ground, and they'd crush the grapes to get the juice out of the grapes. Gideon was threshing. Now, normally, when you threshed, what that involves is it's sorting the ears of the wheat from the husks or the chaff, sorting the wheat from the chaff. And the way that they'd normally do that, they'd go into a breezy place, possibly even on a hillside, and it involved a kind of sieve-type thing, and they would throw all of the wheat and the chaff in the air. The wind would blow the lighter husks away, and the grain would fall. That's what threshing was in those days. And Gideon was doing it inside, probably underground, where there wasn't any breeze. It was a really horrible way of having to do it. He was doing it in a wine press because he needed to be secret, because he was frightened of the Midianites. And yet God turns up, and the first thing he calls him is a mighty man of God. You can almost imagine him saying, "Can't you see what I'm doing? I'm petrified here. I'm hiding in the ground. I'm doing something really difficult because I'm so scared of doing what I want to do in the open air. Yet I'm a mighty man of God." And then his question to God is actually quite reasonable. He's basically saying, "Well, you know, you're saying you're with us, but what's going on here and now? Look what's happening to us. Yet you say that you're still with us." The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" "Pardon me, my lord," Gideon replied, "but how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh. I'm the least in my family." The Lord answered, "I will be with you, and you will strike down all of the Midianites, leaving none alive." Gideon's response, again, is quite sensible. You know, "I'm not a mighty man. I can't really see that you've been doing much in the land for the last 7 years, God. How can I do this? You saw what I was doing, threshing in a wine press." Now, notice here, God doesn't give Gideon a pep talk. He doesn't say, "Now, come on, Gideon, you know, tighten your belt, put on your armor, and go out and fight, and, you know, you can do it. You know, you can take charge of this situation." He doesn't give Gideon a pep talk at all. All he promises is that he'll be with Gideon. And that is all we need. We don't need self-confidence. We need confidence in God. I know in my own life, I have a constant battle, because this probably won't surprise you, those of you who know me, I consider myself really a fairly confident and positive type of person in my own life. You know, I believe fortunately, I believe that's the way I was made. And particularly when I was in business, you know, like, you had to have a certain confidence to do things. You had to be a bit bold at times. You had to make things happen. You couldn't kind of sit back and rely on just hoping that things would happen. You know, I've always been involved in kind of moving things forward and making things happen. And my battle is the opposite of Gideon's, in a way, you know, that I have to be saying to myself, "Look, don't rely in your own strength, rely in God." Other people are at the other end of the scale. You know, Carol mentioned a mom, you know, that was a mighty praying woman, but she had no confidence in herself. And people seem to be at both ends of the spectrum, either full of their own abilities and confidence, and actually God needs to take them down a peg or two, or keep reminding us to rely on Him. Or we actually feel that we're useless, when God needs to remind us and say, "Look, I'm with you. That's all that you need." But I'm sure all of us can relate to either one of those two kind of extremes, if you like. So Gideon, he doesn't just take God at his word. It goes on in verse 17. "If I've now found favor in your eyes, please give me a sign that it is really you talking to me. Please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you." And the Lord said, "I will wait until you return." Gideon went inside, prepared a young goat, and from an ephah of flour, he made bread without yeast, putting the meat in a basket and its broth in a pot. He brought them out and offered them to him under the oak. The angel of God said to him, Take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on this rock, and pour out the broth. And Gideon did so. Then the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread with the tip of his staff, so that it was in his hand. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared. When Gideon realized it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, "Alas, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." So this is the first of the signs that Gideon received. He goes away, he cooks a meal or prepares a meal, he brings it out to the angel of the Lord or the Lord himself, and zap, fire falls down from heaven and the offering, if you like, is accepted. So he had a pretty amazing sign from God. Now, I don't think that was unreasonable. You know, if God says something to you, I don't think it's really a problem to say, "Lord, I think this is what you're saying to me, but would you mind confirming it to me?" I believe God will often provide signs and wonders and confirm. If you think you're hearing from God, don't be frightened to ask for a sign. It's not lack of faith to say, "I'm not sure, Lord, whether it's really you I'm hearing from." Gideon recognizes that it's really God, and actually straight away he's given his first task. So the Lord said to him, "Peace, you're not going to die." So Gideon built an altar to the Lord there and called it "The Lord is Peace." To this day it stands in Ophrah of the Abizarites. That same night the Lord said to him, this is his first task, "Take the second bull from your father's herd, the one that's 7 years old." In other words, that's pretty much the best one, you know, the second one. The first one wouldn't necessarily have been the prime one. "Take the second bull, the one that's 7 years old, tear down your father's altar to Baal and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on the top of this height. Using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down, offer the second bull as a burnt offering." So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him. But because he was afraid of his family and the townspeople, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. In the morning, when the people of the town got up, there was Baal's altar demolished, with the Asherah pole beside it cut down, and the second bull was sacrificed on the newly built altar. They asked each other, "Who did this?" When they carefully investigated, they were told, "Gideon, son of Joash, did it. The people of the town demanded of Joash, 'Bring out your son, he must die,' because he's broken down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. But Joash replied to the hostile crowd around him, 'Are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar.' So because Gideon broke down Baal's altar, they gave him the name Jerubbaal that day, saying, 'Let Baal contend with him.' Now all the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern peoples joined forces and crossed over the Jordan and camped in the valley of Jezreel. Then the Spirit of the Lord came on Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, summoning the Abizarites to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, calling them to arms, and also into Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, so that they too went up to meet him." So this is Gideon's first test. He's told by God, and this is quite remarkable when you think about it, Gideon's own dad had an altar to Baal in his house and had one of these despicable Asherah poles in his own property. And God actually says to Gideon, "Start your tasks close to home. Start the work at home first." In other words, put your own house in order before you start trying to deal with other people's problems. Isn't that a great word to receive from God? Isn't it often the way God speaks to us? "John, you feel you're being called to this, but I know what's going on at your home. That's got to be put right before. You know, if you think you're going to lead a church, you've got to get stuff sorted with me first." For all of us, that's often the way that God will speak to us. He may very well end up putting his finger on something that's really close to home, something to do with a relationship that's not right, something to do with a situation at work that's not correct, something to do with the way you're living your life, you're treating your possessions. I don't know. But God will very often point or touch. You know, he'll push on a bruise. You know what I mean? You've got a bit of a bruise, and he'll put his finger on that bruise sometimes and just say, sort that out. Gideon was frightened to do it, so he did this at night. I don't know why, because the next morning they found out it was him anyway. But at night, he went out, but at least he was obedient. And because he was obedient, he got quite a few surprise outcomes. The first one is this: his dad supported him. His dad actually said, when they came to take him, "Look, hold on, that's my son, and he's done something right. If Baal's really a god, let Baal sort Gideon out. You leave him alone." So he won his dad round. Often we worry about our families. Sometimes God can step into a family situation miraculously. But Gideon then gets a new name. He's called Jerubbaal. He gets a new name out of it. And he gets full of the Holy Spirit. All of that was the reward of being obedient to God in the first place. He then blows a trumpet and actually summons a fantastic army. In fact, the army is so great that it's too big for God to use. It's too good an army. We're not going to cover that this morning, but that's all in the next chapter. I'm sure you know the story of Gideon having to cut down the army and cut down the army so God could really prove it was him working. But Gideon, full of the Holy Spirit, blows a trumpet, and before he knows it, he's got a mighty army around him. But even then, after all of that, the miracle that he saw, obeying God, he still has doubts. He still has doubts. Gideon said to God, "If you will save Israel by my hand, as you promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. If there is dew only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you said." And that is what happened. Gideon rose early the next day. He squeezed the fleece and wrung out the dew, a bowlful of water. Then Gideon said to God, "Don't be angry with me, but let me make just one more request. Allow me one more test with the fleece. But this time make the fleece dry and let the ground be covered with dew." That night, God did so. Only the fleece was dry. All the ground was covered with dew. So you can see here, Gideon has a first sign, the sacrifice of the meal. He asks for a second time, for a second sign. And then he thirdly asks for another sign. And he starts by saying this to God: "If you will save Israel by my hand, as you've promised." In other words, if you're not lying to me. That's really cheeky, isn't it? He's actually saying to God, "Look, I've heard you. I'm not doubting what you've said. I'm not doubting that you said it. I'm doubting that you really mean what you said. I don't know, you probably have heard the expression, you know, I'm going to put a fleece out. We sometimes use that in church circles. It's sometimes a good thing. There's a couple of situations in our church at the moment where we're definitely having to kind of put a fleece out. We're definitely having to say, look, we think this is right. We're going to do this. And if God answers and speaks this way, then we're going to accept that it's God speaking to us. There are times where it's right to put a fleece out. But asking for a second and a third sign was a sign of weak faith. But Gideon still had faith, no matter how weak it was. You know, one of the biggest questions, I believe, that we ever ask ourselves, and certainly from a pastoral point of view, this comes up time and time again. And the question is this: how can I know what God's will is for my life? What's God's will for me? And sometimes it can be really practical. It can be, I've been offered this job, you know, is it God's will for me to take this job? Is it God's will for me to get involved in a relationship with this person? And sometimes we put God to the test. You know, sometimes we can say something as simple to God as, you know, God, I really fancy this person. I tell you what, as long as the sun comes up tomorrow morning, I'll accept that it's your will for me to ask them. Or, Lord, you know, I really like this person, so I really do want to ask them out. But if you send a midget to my door at 3 o'clock in the morning and he tells me not to do it, I won't do it. Is that all right? You know, we're so specific with the tests that we might give God. Gideon was pretty specific. You know, look, I'm going to put this fleece out. If it's wet and the ground's dry, that's great. And then he did that. Let's try it the other way around. Let's really test God. And people agonize. People agonize over knowing God's will in their lives. There's a verse here that I want to just read to you. This is what Paul says about this. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And then this is the key. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. We can prove the good and acceptable will of God. How? By offering our bodies as living sacrifices, living our lives in the way to please God, and actually not conforming to the patterns of the world, but allowing our mind to be transformed. We can perhaps overcomplicate it. Jesus made it quite clear that we're not meant to worry about tomorrow. He said, today's got enough worries of itself. Don't worry about tomorrow, what you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, where you're going to go. Worry about today. Today's got enough worries of its own. Sometimes God can't show us too much of what the future holds. It may be too much for us to cope with, either good or bad. He may have such fantastic plans for us that we'll just get blown away if he showed them to us now. Similarly, things, I don't want to be a prophet of doom here, but things may be going to get that difficult that actually, if you really realized how hard it was going to be, if God revealed that to you in advance, you just might give up the ghost and not cope with it. If Gideon knew really what he'd got to do, if God had actually said to him, you know, you're going to do these Midianites and you're not going to do it with a mighty army, but, you know, you're just going to take a few men and you're really going to trust me, he possibly would have said, there's no way. God knows what we need. He knows what we need to know about. He is in charge, and his message is, be at peace. Trust me, and you will prove what my will is, but it might be just taking things one day at a time. Don't stress over it too much. By living one day at a time, we can prove the good and acceptable will of God in our lives. Gideon was dictating his terms to God, and that's not a good thing to do. It really isn't. I've joked about it a bit, but it really isn't a good thing to set God really stupid challenges and say, well, then I'll really know it's you. Gideon had a little faith, a little tiny weak faith, but God could use that. When God writes to the churches in the book of Revelation, there's one church, I think it's Philadelphia, where it says, God says this to them, he says, you know, I've seen your works, and you have a little faith. And actually, when you read it to start with, you think it's a criticism, but actually it's a commendation. God can see that little faith. Jesus talked about faith the size of the grain of a mustard seed, which is one of the tiniest seeds of all. That's all you need to move mountains. Gideon had an unbelievable challenge ahead. I think because the challenge was so great, God kind of graciously allowed him to put him through this testing process. I don't think it's the way that God wants us to be all of the time. His faith may have been weak, but what little faith he had was real, and that is what God looks for in our lives. You may feel weak, you may feel insignificant, you may feel you've been relying on your own strength too much, but God can see the kernel of that little bit of faith, and he can use it. Gideon is mentioned in the letter to the Hebrews. I think it's chapter 11, where the writer to the letter of Hebrews writes about men of faith in the Old Testament. Gideon's name appears there. He was a weak person that was considered a mighty man of God. I'm sure we can all relate to him. And I just want to end by saying this. Weak faith in a mighty God can accomplish great things. So bless you. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you found that illuminating. I hope God's spoken to you through it. If If there's anything that I've put my finger on this morning, it's not me, because I don't know you. It's the Holy Spirit. So if there are challenges in your life and something that I've said somehow has just touched you, perhaps, like I said earlier, you know, like a bruise being pressed a little bit, if you'd like to come and have a chat, have a pray, I'd love nothing more than that afterwards.